The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the June 18th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week actually has two different scenes in it. The picture is split diagonally. In the upper left-hand corner is a picture of a cave with bats flying out of it. In the lower right-hand corner is a laboratory scientist in full gear, Dr. Xingli Shi. And she has got a petri dish with something growing in it. And the headline is, "The Origins of COVID. Did the coronavirus come from nature or Wuhan lab?" That story comes in our controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main story titled, "Manchin's Stance Threatens Biden's Agenda." What happened? Panicked Democrats tried to fashion a path forward for federal voting rights legislation and for Biden's ambitious progressive agenda after Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia declared he would not support the sweeping voting bill, H.R. 1, or a change to the Senate filibuster rules. "I believe that partisan voting legislation will destroy the already weakening binds of our democracy," the centrist Democrat wrote in a column in his home state's Charleston Gazette Mail. "Furthermore, I will not vote to weaken or eliminate the filibuster." Manchin's announcement effectively derailed Democrats' hopes of passing the voting bill, which would establish national voting standards and nullify restrictive voting measures being passed in many Republican states. Co-sponsored by every Democrat other than Manchin, it faces unanimous Republican opposition in the 50-50 Senate. Manchin's announcement enraged progressives who called the wave of restrictive state voting bills a threat to democracy. "Manchin is doing the work of the Republican Party," said Representative Jamal Bowman, a Democrat from New York. As Democrats grappled with the implications of Manchin's opposition to passing legislation without Republican support, which threatens bills on gun safety, immigration reform, and climate change, efforts to reach a compromise on an infrastructure bill collapsed. President Biden said he and Senate Republicans were too far apart on the size of the package and the inclusion of tax increases to pay for it. The impasse drove home the increasingly dim prospects for Biden's legislative agenda if the filibuster remains intact. "It's a real blow," said University of Chicago political scientist William Howell. "The Biden agenda has been kneecapped by this." What the editorial said: "Manchin is playing political chess and doing Democrats a favor," said the Wall Street Journal. "The canny operator knows pushing through a far-left agenda unilaterally would prompt a backlash that would cost Democrats control of Congress in 2022. Many Democrats in swing districts are quietly happy to let Manchin be the fall guy. Democrats still have a budget reconciliation card to play, and Manchin will probably support a large tax and spend bill traveling under the false flag of infrastructure. The truth is, H.R. 1 is poorly matched to the moment," said the New York Times. "The sprawling bill is simply not feasible in a divided Congress and nation and would not stop state GOP legislatures from passing laws that would enable them to overturn the will of voters. Instead of waging a futile fight, Democrats should confront the acute crisis at hand by crafting a more focused bill that might draw wider support, aimed at preventing voting access rollbacks and subversion of election results by partisan state officials." What the columnist said: Manchin has become the Senate's Walter Mitty, said James Downey in the Washington Post. He sees himself as a noble champion of a long-dead bipartisan spirit who will save the country by recruiting 10 good Republicans who do not exist. Earth to Joe. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has publicly vowed to block 100% of Biden's agenda. Manchin says that partisan policymaking will destroy democracy, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But Republican state legislatures are forcing through racist vote suppression laws on a party line basis, and Manchin's incoherent stance guarantees they will succeed. Cries of racism are an attempt to bludgeon Manchin into submission, said Rich Lowry in the National Review. A rare Democrat with principles, Manchin understands the filibuster is a guardrail designed to keep a party with a slim majority from enacting a far-reaching radical agenda by ramming through bills like H.R. 1, a constitutionally dubious monstrosity that would trample on state voting laws and federalize elections. Biden's hopes for a historic legislative legacy appear to be headed for a wall, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. For all the hopeful FDR comparisons and his early victory on COVID relief, the moment was always going to come when his vast political agenda would hit the blockade of Washington's uncompromising political math. Manchin's stubborn intransigence, a divided Democratic coalition, and a Republican Party transformed into Trump's personality cult have now brought Biden to a moment of truth. It remains to be seen how much of his dream of being a transformative president can be salvaged. Controversy of the week, the lab leak hypothesis. What does the evidence suggest? Remember last year's outlandish xenophobic conspiracy theory that the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus escaped from a Chinese laboratory where it was genetically engineered to infect humans? In the past few weeks, scientists and liberal pundits have become less swift to dismiss the lab leak theory, said Benjamin Wallace Wells in The New Yorker. The initial consensus among scientists was that the virus that caused COVID-19 jumped from horseshoe bats in southern China to humans by zoonotic spillover, most likely through close proximity of species at the Wuhan live animal market. But now it's clear we have two dueling hypotheses, each with missing evidence. The evidence for the lab leak theory is stronger, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. We know now that under the leadership of Dr. Xi Zhengli, known as China's Bat Lady, researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the WIV, were engaged in so-called gain-of-function research, engineering bat coronaviruses to make them human transmissible. In November 2019, three of those researchers went to the hospital with COVID-like symptoms. We do need an investigation, said virologists Angela Rasmussen and Stephen Goldstein in the Washington Post, but the data so far still points heavily toward a natural origin. Virologists studying the coronavirus genome see no evidence of deliberate alteration. On the contrary, the virus notorious spike protein was, at the outset of the pandemic, far from optimal for human-to-human transmission, strongly suggesting sloppy natural evolution, not human engineering, as its origin. Once it infected humans, the virus has naturally and rapidly evolved variants that are far more infectious. Let's not forget that many of our viral diseases, including the Spanish flu, SARS, and HIV, originated in animals before jumping species, said Umair Irfan in Vox.com. SARS-CoV-2 is very similar to dozens of bat viruses found in China. There was ample opportunity for it to spread and mutate in nature before it made the final jump into humans. Not so fast, said Stephen Quay in the Wall Street Journal. While much of the evidence for a lab leak is circumstantial, there is one damning fact that proponents of natural origin have yet to explain. The genetic makeup of the virus spike protein contains a specific pairing of genes known as a double CGG that has never been found naturally, but which researchers like Xi have been using since 1992 to supercharge coronaviruses and make them more infectious. Some of Xi's research was funded directly by grants from our own National Institutes of Health, said Catherine Eban in VanityFair.com. The NIH denies funding any gain-of-function research, but admits it can't be sure how its funds were used. This may explain why in January 2020, a State Department official privately sent a memo to colleagues warning that looking into the lab leak theory might open a can of worms. President Biden has given U.S. intelligence 90 days to do further digging and report back, said Christina Larson in the Associated Press. But scientists say it's unlikely that any definitive answer will be possible in that time frame. Tracking down the origins of past viral pandemics such as SARS and HIV took more than 15 years. China's authoritarian government, already facing international embarrassment that COVID began in Wuhan, has made it clear it will not cooperate with additional investigations that might pin blame on its scientists. As frustrating as it may be, we may never get a smoking gun that proves how this pandemic began. It was a good week for recalculating. After U.S. Airlines said that they are adding 5 to 10 pounds to the average weight of passengers and their baggage to avoid the safety risk of overloaded planes. It was a good week for moving to the Southern Hemisphere after the Economist Intelligence Unit rated Auckland, New Zealand, as the world's most livable city. Not only is Auckland beautiful, the unit says, New Zealand's tough lockdown early in the pandemic enabled residents to enjoy a lifestyle that looked similar to pre-pandemic life. And it was a good week for prioritizing, with Germany's announcement that before it withdraws its 1,100 troops from Afghanistan, it will fly home their huge stockpile of alcohol, more than 60,000 cans of beer, and hundreds of bottles of wine and champagne. But it was a bad week for Karen, which plunged 171 places in the Social Security Administration's latest annual ranking of popular baby names. Newly saddled with connotations of white entitlement and a chronic need to speak to the manager, Karen was the chosen name of only 325 babies in 2020, down from more than 33,000 in 1965. It was a bad week for the monarchy after Oxford University students voted to take down a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II from a common room because she represents recent colonial history. The motion to remove her was brought by an American lecturer in computer science. Finally, it was a bad week for free snacks after the Food and Drug Administration warned that people with seafood allergies should not eat the crunchy cicadas currently covering the ground in 15 states. These insects share a family relation to shrimp and lobsters, explains the agency. A briefing article is titled "The Tulsa Race Massacre." A century ago this month, a white mob destroyed a thriving black neighborhood in Tulsa. What was Black Wall Street? In the early 1900s, Tulsa, Oklahoma was a racially segregated city of about 100,000 people, with about 9,000 black residents confined to the Greenwood neighborhood. forbidden from patronizing or opening businesses on the white side of town, Black Tulsans established Greenwood as a bustling middle-class neighborhood with more than 200 businesses spread across 35 blocks, including 15 doctors, 2 newspapers, luxury shops, restaurants, hotels, theaters, salons, and a library. Black Wall Street, as some called it, also had its own school system, post office, savings and loan bank, and hospital. Many white Tulsans resented the bustling, self-contained prosperity of what they derisively called Little Africa and N-word town. And racial tension simmered. Greenwood disproved the whole idea that racial superiority was a fact of life, said Jim Goodwin, current publisher of the Oklahoma Eagle, a black newspaper. On May 30, 1921, a spark ignited racial resentment into terrible violence. What happened? Dick Rowland, a 19-year-old black shoeshiner, stepped into an elevator in the Drexel Building in downtown Tulsa to use the coloreds-only restroom on the top floor. The elevator operator was a 17-year-old white girl, Sarah Page, who ran out of the elevator screaming. No one knows what happened. In the black community, it was said that Rowland tripped and grabbed onto Page's arm. The next day, the Tulsa Tribune ran a front-page story saying Rowland scratched and tore her clothes, an accusation that in that era was tantamount to an attempted rape. Rowland was arrested by police, and a lynch mob of hundreds of men quickly assembled outside the courthouse, demanding Rowland be handed over. A group of about 75 black men rushed to the scene to protect Rowland. A scuffle broke out between the two groups, a gun discharged, and witnesses said all hell broke loose. That night, a white mob of more than 1,000, including police officers, descended on Greenwood for a 13-hour orgy of violence. What did the mob do? The attackers looted and ransacked homes, set nearly every structure on fire, and shot men, women, and children. At least one machine gun was reportedly used in the massacre. The terror even rained down from above as pilots dropped homemade incendiary bombs from crop dusters over the neighborhood. As many as 300 people were killed, and 1,471 homes were burned or looted. More than 800 were injured, and 8,000 people were left homeless. I still see black men being shot, black bodies lying in the street, Viola Fletcher, a 107-year-old survivor, recently said in testimony before Congress. I still see black businesses being burned. I hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through this massacre every day. What happened to the survivors? Many were taken into custody and forced to march with their hands in the air at gunpoint through white neighborhoods while being taunted and humiliated. Several prominent black men were charged with inciting a riot. No white person was ever charged with a serious crime or imprisoned. Insurance companies refused to pay damage claims, and Greenwood families lived in tents and shanties for much of the next year. Greenwood did begin to rebuild later that year, but most families never recovered their lost wealth. How much was lost? A 2001 report by an Oklahoma State Commission put the cost of the properties destroyed in Greenwood at $1.8 million, or $27 million in today's dollars. R.T. Bridgewater, a black doctor and property owner, lost 17 houses he had built as rental investment properties. O.W. Gurley, a wealthy landowner who founded Greenwood in 1906, lost nearly $158,000, equivalent to $2.3 million today. The Tulsa Massacre was a dramatic example of how African Americans have been denied the opportunity to accumulate wealth. To this day, 1 out of 3 black people in the Greenwood area live in poverty, and the median income for black households is $30,955, about 55% of white households. Still, the true story of the Tulsa massacre was hidden until very recently. In what way? For 80 years, Oklahoma schools did not mention the destruction of Greenwood in teaching local history. It wasn't until 2002 that the Oklahoma Education Department added the Tulsa Race Riot, as it called that event, to the state academic standards, but only as an example of rising racial tensions during the period. Even in the black community, the topic was addressed in whispers, if at all. It was taboo to speak about it, said Vanessa Hall Harper, a member of Tulsa's city council. I didn't even know about the massacre until I was an adult. In 2019, a commission organized to mark the massacre's centennial finally convinced the state education department to include lessons on the destruction of Greenwood. Still, no attempt has been made to repay families or the community for what was stolen from them. The historical trauma is real, said Alice Ottewald, an archaeologist at the University of Tulsa. That trauma lingers especially because there's no justice, no accountability, and no reparation or monetary compensation. Read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Trump's dangerous fantasies. Conservatives can't afford to ignore the startling scale of Donald Trump's delusions, said Charles Cook. When Maggie Haberman of the New York Times reported last week that Trump has been telling close supporters that he expects to be reinstated this August, some figures on the right dismissed it as fake news. But many of my own Republican sources confirm Trump truly does believe that the bogus audit of the election in Arizona will prove he won, and that similar audits of other swing states will lead to his being declared the winner of the 2020 election. If Trump were a fringe figure, his delusional thinking could be dismissed. But the ex-president remains a highly influential figure within the GOP, and he's using his lie about election fraud as a litmus test for Republican candidates in 2022 and 2024. Let's be clear. Trump's obscene fantasy of being reinstated in the White House represents a rejection of the entire system of American government. It is simply not how America works. You don't have to be a Democrat to acknowledge that the former president is unmoored from the real world, and that his insistence he's the real president is deeply corrosive to our democracy. The Swiss Army knife of mass death. Is an AR-15 capable of killing 50 people in a minute no different from a Swiss Army knife? Asked Kimberly Well. That's the contention of federal judge Roger Benitez, a George W. Bush appointee, who last week struck down California's ban on assault-style weapons as unconstitutional by insisting they are fairly ordinary, popular, modern rifles. Appeals will probably take the case to the Supreme Court, where conservatives have been openly calling for a chance to clarify and expand on the court's 2008 Heller ruling, stating that individuals have the right to own a handgun for self-defense. But in that 5-4 ruling, Justice Antonin Scalia underscored that the Second Amendment does not provide a right to own any weapon whatsoever, and that unusually dangerous weapons could be banned. Assault-style rifles are designed to quickly kill dozens of people, which is why mass shooters have used them to create horrific carnage in Boulder, Orlando, Parkland, Las Vegas, Aurora, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Sutherland Springs, and the Tree of Life Synagogue. In his ruling, Benitez said these weapons have been used in only 22% of mass shootings. For some of us, that's 22% too many. This column comes from Canada. the tedium of endless weed stores. From the looks of my Toronto neighborhood, the pandemic has killed off nearly every business except for weed dispensaries, said Emma Teetle. While the economy as a whole languished during the year of lockdowns, the marijuana industry took off in Canada. In Ontario alone, 50 weed outlets are opening every month. As I walk down my block, I pass the following. Pot shop, empty shop. Pot shop, empty shop. Pot shop, empty pots. Literally, a plant store went out of business. It's a jarring effect. The marijuana dispensaries are chic and modern. One even has friendly millennials standing outside all day handing out dog treats. The other storefronts are shabby and sad, boarded up, and covered in graffiti. The only common denominator in the open and shuttered business is that it's difficult to see inside them. When Canada legalized recreational marijuana in 2018, the law stipulated that dispensaries must hide away their wares so as not to tempt abstainers. To keep in compliance, most of the shops are fronted in frosted or mirrored glass, or covered in posters, which leaves the street looking pretty bleak. My 15-year-old self would kill me for saying this, but I can only hope that the oversaturation of the market will cause some of these stores to fail. The last word, our in-depth article, is titled, Living on a Volcano. Stromboli's rumbling volcano is a constant presence in the lives of those who live on the Italian island, said Robin George Andrews in the New York Times. They enjoy the danger, but know it could erupt at any time. If you stand at the summit at night and you turn your flashlight off, all you can see are diamantine flecks shimmering in the dark. In that moment, you are floating, untethered, in an endless inky pool. The inevitable rumblings of the blackened earth beneath your feet eventually remind you remain on this planet. And when a jet of incandescent molten rock shoots skyward and illuminates the land like a flare, you feel as if you are staring down a dragon. For those seeking to experience the raw and almost preternatural power of a volcano, you would be hard-pressed to find a better place than Stromboli, northwest of the toe of Italy's boot and aptly known as the Lighthouse of the Mediterranean. Rising a mere 3,000 feet above the waves of the Tyrrhenian Sea, the seemingly diminutive volcano Isle is famed for its near-continuous summit explosions. Most volcanoes spend much of their time in a state of quiescence, but Stromboli bucks that trend. It's always active, said Maurizio Ripep, a geophysicist at the University of Florence in Italy. I always say it's the most reliable thing in Italy. It's not like the trains. Stromboli is also home to a few hundred full-time residents. Their relationship with the volcano is largely cordial. Its regular explosive activity is confined to the summit, and a slope named the Scaria del Fuoco, Stream of Fire, harmlessly funnels superheated debris into the sea. The frequent window-rattling booms have become barely noticeable background noise, while its effervescence has proved highly attractive to paying tourists. But the volcano is capable of acts of utter devastation. Rare but especially fierce blasts have killed people both at the summit and on its slopes. That danger makes Stromboli a resplendent place punctured with moments of terror. Gaia Squarci, a photographer and videographer who first visited the island when she was 17, said there is always a calm with a tension underneath. Everyone has a unique relationship with this paradoxical landscape. Scientists approach Stromboli as detectives. They hope to understand how it works by investigating its various viscera, a task aided by both its hyperactivity and its easy accessibility. There are not so many volcanoes that you can go up to the summit, you work all day long, then you are only 1 hour from beer, pizza, good food, said Ripepe. Small explosions rock Stromboli's summit all the time. Although it's a safe environment to work in for the most part, scientists are acutely aware that the volcano is capable of unleashing more potent explosions. These blasts, referred to as paroxysms, are considered to be a major threat. If they are powerful enough to dislodge part of the volcano, some can even trigger tsunamis. Although the volcano has been relatively calm during the past half century, the past few years have seen a return to violent form. In July 2019, a paroxysm killed a hiker and injured several others. The next month, another shook the island, but fortunately, no one died that time. The authorities, fearing further paroxysms, subsequently closed the summit to visitors. Jacopo Crimi, originally from Milan, was often brought to the island as a child by his parents. Today he lives there, helping scientists present and share their work with their peers, clients, and the general public. He describes living on Stromboli as a bit like being on one of the miniature planets in the universe of the Little Prince. The story by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, where the eponymous boy visits a number of lonely worlds. Crimi says residents get to know the volcano and its personality as if it were a living thing. It's strange, it's like a person, he said. You really miss it when you leave here. You feel lost. Travelers will always want to visit the island, too, because erupting volcanoes provide a spectacle like no other. We love danger in some ways. It lets us feel immortal, Crimi says. It brings fear and joy together. The human presence makes volcanologists nervous. The volcano is nearly 2 miles tall, but only the uppermost part is above water. They're not living at the base of a volcano, said Ripepe. They're living at the top of the volcano, right next to its magmatic maw. No one on the island is far from harm's way. The overarching goal of the science of volcanology is to detect warning signs of an eruption, allowing those in danger to protect themselves. Volcanoes usually twitch and convulse before an eruption, but some dangerous phenomena give no discernible fanfare. For example, a pressure cooker-like bomb of underground water exploded without warning on New Zealand's Waikare White Island volcano on December 9, 2019, killing 22 visitors. Stromboli's eternal effervescence makes it a fantastic natural laboratory for trials of eruption forecasting. Could the island's own explosions, which happen rather suddenly, be seen coming? It's known that many volcanoes inflate when the magma rises into them. This doesn't always mean an eruption is forthcoming, but sometimes it does. Stromboli is no exception. Devices that measure the changing shape of the volcano have been recording its metamorphosis for 2 decades, and scientists have noticed Stromboli inflates not at random, but every time the volcano is about to explode. The inflation in this case appears to happen when the gases dissolved in the ascending magma escape into a lower pressure environment within the volcano's shallow conduit, the esophagus-like passageway to the surface. Despite the erratic nature of Stromboli, there is a rule in the chaos, Ripepe says. The scientist's discovery was published in the journal Nature Communications in March, but an early warning system based on their data has been set up and running since October 2019. If the volcano inflates in a way that indicates a paroxysm is coming, an automated alert is sent to the civil authorities and volcanologist who then activate a series of sirens. From the moment the signal is detected, everyone has up to 10 minutes to react before the paroxysm arrives. That may be sufficient to save the lives of many, either from the paroxysm itself or any subsequent tsunami. But it's not a panacea. If you are at the summit, there is no way to survive, said Repepe. Either the explosion shock wave will crush your internal organs, or the hot ash and gas will asphyxiate you. He and his colleagues are now hoping to find other precursors that will give people hours to get to safety. Deciphering the complex series of grumbles and twitches exhibited by volcanoes in the run-up to an eruption is rarely straightforward. But when efforts to identify precursors to volcanic violence are successful, they can provide salvation. Take La Soufriere, a volcano on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent, as an example. It had been erupting in a calm and harmless manner since December. But suspicious seismic activity in late March and early April was interpreted by scientists as a sign that something explosive was on its way. They persuaded the government to order an evacuation on April 8th of tens of thousands of people living in the volcano's shadow. The very next day, the first in a series of catastrophic blasts rocked La Soufriere. Thanks to that early warning and subsequent exodus, no lives were lost to the volcano's rage. No matter what advances are made in eruption forecasting, Stromboli, like all volcanoes, remains capable of surprising everyone. It's humbling, the fact that we can get better and better at predicting patterns of behavior, but there will always be a high degree of unpredictability, said Squarchi. According to Crimi, plenty of Stromboli's longtime residents, including those who rely on tourism for their income, don't want to engage with volcanologists, as they are seen to challenge the island-wide illusion that the volcano can do no harm. But for some, the knowledge that the specter of death always exists is a thing of counterintuitive beauty. Scientists can try to comprehend Stromboli, but nothing they will do will alter the volcano's actions. The volcano wrote the chapters of the island's history, said Squarchi, and it will be the author of the island's future, too. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. I'm going to read a business column for you this week. Ransomware, an epidemic of digital extortion. Our nation's infrastructure is facing an unprecedented onslaught of cyber attacks, said Rishi Iyengar and Claire Duffy in CNN.com. Last week, the country's biggest meat processor became a target of hackers demanding ransom, even as a major oil pipeline was just recovering from a ransomware attack that shut off oil to much of the southeast. The latest victims even include the ferry to Martha's Vineyard, the Obama's vacation spot. Hackers used to focus mainly on stealing data, but increasingly brazen perpetrators, often based in Russia, have found a significant moneymaker in targeting physical infrastructure and demanding payment to unlock critical systems. FBI Director Christopher Wray compared the urgency of the threat to the scramble against international terrorism after 9/11. By tracing the route of the Bitcoin payment, the FBI was able to recover most of the $4.4 million paid to reopen the Colonial Pipeline. But the attacks on the oil and food industries have demonstrated the potential to spark mayhem in people's lives. The FBI advises not to pay hackers, said Rachel Monroe in The New Yorker, but many feel they have no choice, giving rise to a small industry of ransomware negotiators. These half-dozen specialists and the insurance companies they regularly partner with help people navigate the world of cyber extortion. They have been accused of abetting crime by incentivizing the holding of digital hostages. But they have no lack of clients. According to one negotiating firm, the average ransom payment in the first 3 months of the year was $220,000, said Adrian Croft in Fortune. That's a 43% increase from the previous quarter. One consultant, Curtis Minder, said the most he'd ever paid on behalf of a client, a large engineering company, was $2.75 million. The fact that such payments often go unreported suggests the scale of the problem is much bigger than publicly disclosed. The recent surge feels new, but ransomware has been a huge business for years, said Patrick Howell O'Neill in MIT Technology Review. Years of American inaction have let the problem metastasize, while cybercrime gangs have become much more sophisticated. They used to indiscriminately infect vulnerable machines without much care for the payoff. Now they are going big game hunting. Despite the years of warnings, many businesses are woefully unprepared, said Nicole Perlroth in the New York Times. Their systems run on buggy and out-of-date software nobody bothers to patch. And in some cases, employees aren't even trained to use different passwords. Regulators and legislators rushed to Capitol Hill after the pipeline attack to implement new requirements, said Tim Culpin in Bloomberg.com. But oil companies and pipeline operators have successfully lobbied against stricter cybersecurity rules for more than a decade. The fact that any one industry has the power to stymie cybersecurity legislation puts our entire nation in jeopardy. Yes, some systems, nuclear power stations for instance, may hold special dangers. But the way to make our digital borders more secure is to make sure we have no weak links. We'll turn on over to the health and science page. Evening exercise is better. Working out in the evening may be better for the body than exercising in the morning. Researchers in Australia recruited 24 sedentary overweight men and put them on a high-fat diet for 5 days. After that, participants were divided into three exercise groups. One started exercising at 6:30 a.m., the second at 6:30 p.m., the third not at all. The participants stuck with the exercise regimens for 5 consecutive days while continuing the high-fat diet. As expected, the men's health suffered during the first 5 days of fatty eating. Their bad cholesterol levels rose, and their blood showed signs of increased risk for heart problems. The results from the second 5 days were more surprising. In the evening exercisers, some changes were mitigated or reversed, while morning exercisers showed the same heightened cholesterol and troubling indicators in their blood as the non-exercising control group. Studies have shown that lack of sleep can disrupt metabolism, reports Insider.com, so it's possible that men who woke early to exercise may have missed out on some valuable shut-eye. Still, the researchers emphasize any exercise at any time of day is better than no exercise. The elephant's exceptionally useful trunk. Scientists have long marveled at the elephant's trunk, a muscular appendage the animal uses for everything from drinking and smelling to ripping up trees and issuing 110 decibel trumpet-like blasts. It's now been discovered that trunks can also be used to suck up food, a skill previously thought to be exclusive to certain fish. The researchers worked with Kelly, a 34-year-old African elephant at Zoo Atlanta, reports The Atlantic. When Kelly was presented with large rutabaga cubes, she used her trunk's tiny fingers to grab them before maneuvering the snack into her mouth. But when offered a tortilla chip, she used the suction to lift the chip without breaking it. The talent is a product of Kelly's massive nostrils. The researchers calculated that her schnoz could inhale water at speeds of more than 490 feet per second, 30 times faster than humans can sneeze out of theirs. The scientists note that elephants may not use suction much in the wild because dust and debris could clog their airways. But lead researcher Andrew Schultz from Georgia Tech said the research nevertheless pushes all of the extremes of what we understand animals to be able to do. And we're on the talking points page. Time for two or three articles, actually. Start with Osaka, a tennis star's struggle with anxiety. Congratulations, tennis, said Jameel Hill in TheAtlantic.com. You just bullied one of the biggest stars in your sport into quitting the French Open. Before the start of the tournament, Naomi Osaka announced on Instagram that she planned to skip its obligatory press conferences, writing that aggressive questioning by reporters deepens the anxiety and depression she suffered since winning the 2018 U.S. Open in a high-pressure final against Serena Williams. French Open officials fined Osaka $15,000 for refusing to meet with the press. She then withdrew from the tournament. The decision by Osaka, 23, brought a mixture of criticism, sympathy, and surprise. No one realized that such a tough player on the court might be in genuine emotional distress. Osaka's mental health is more important than any soundbite, said Andrew Marchand in the New York Post. But the interviews sports writers conduct with athletes are not mere nuisances. We ask questions on behalf of fans, probing to reveal players' thoughts and feelings and helping to make them three-dimensional human beings. But today's generation of athletes prefer to relate to the public in one-dimensional tweets and Instagram posts so they can manage their own images. Osaka, who made $55 million last year, evidently did not want to be asked about her history of poor performances on clay courts like the French Opens, said Will Leitch in nymag.com. That's understandable, especially now that we know she struggled with anxiety and self-doubt. Still, the Open officials were not wrong to suggest that allowing Osaka alone to skip press conferences could give her an unfair advantage over other players. It's not something that Osaka just gets to decide out of the blue right before a tournament starts. Pro athletes do have obligations to their sport and the public that enriches them, said Barry Cervoluga in the Washington Post. But Osaka is human, not a cyborg, and also has obligations to her own well-being. Pro tennis especially is exposing young players to a grueling regimen of nearly year-round work, isolation, and incredible pressure to succeed. Witty and outspoken on social justice issues, the multiracial Osaka may be one of the most compelling figures in tennis. Let's hope that at some point she will feel ready to compete and speak publicly again. Harris, being set up to fail? Is Kamala Harris drawing the shortest straws in the White House? Asked Lisa Lehrer in the New York Times. President Biden last week again gave the vice president a nearly impossible mission, asking her to lead the administration's battle against GOP-led voter suppression. It's going to take a hell of a lot of work, Biden told Harris in an extreme understatement. Voting rights legislation is doomed in the 50-50 Senate unless Democrats eliminate the filibuster, which Senator Joe Manchin refuses to do. Harris, the first woman and first woman of color to be vice president, already has been given the unenviable job of stemming migration at the southern border, among the most intractable and polarizing issues in politics. Harris, who went to Central America this week to address root causes of migration, actually requested both assignments, said Cleve Wootson in the Washington Post. But if Biden's heir apparent flops, it could stoke disappointment in the party and diminish her standing. Harris is off to an unimpressive start, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. 3 months after Harris took on the border crisis, attempted border crossings are at a 21-year high. With her aides reportedly dismayed, she is now seen as the border czar. Harris has reversed her opposition to border closures to stem the tide, but that quickly brought sharp criticism from progressives. Harris is already unusually unpopular for a VEEP, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. A recent YouGov poll showed her approval rating at 41%, and she's 25 points underwater among independents. a highly partisan senator from California before joining Biden's ticket, Harris has become a political liability for her boss. Voter sentiment regarding Biden's handling of immigration dropped after he named Harris to head up the efforts. Republicans are probably already designing attack ads in the event Harris is the Democrats' presidential nominee in 2024, said Peter Funt in USA Today. Biden will be 81 that year and may well choose not to seek re-election, making Harris the party's presumptive frontrunner. But over the past 180 years, George H.W. Bush was the only vice president to be elected to succeed his boss. And now Biden has dumped two of the most radioactive issues facing the nation on Harris' plate. With Democrats already deeply anxious about 2014, Biden, intentionally or not, appears to be setting up Harris to fail. Fauci, the uproar over his emails. Right-wing attacks on Anthony Fauci took on a whole new level of vitriol this week, said Natasha Korecki and Sarah Owen Mole in Politico.com. Long a boogeyman for conservatives who question his response to the pandemic, the nation's top infectious disease doctor came under renewed fire after the release of thousands of his emails under the Freedom of Information Act. Fauci immediately faced bombardment from the right with a hashtag Fauci lies trending on Twitter. Senators Rand Paul and Josh Hawley calling for his resignation, and reports that Donald Trump planned to make him the new Hillary Clinton. Critics claim that the emails prove Fauci squelched evidence that the virus leaked from a Chinese lab and lied about the efficacy of masks. That's not what the emails actually say, but the attacks highlighted the growing intensity of conservative hatred for a mild-mannered scientist who's earned bipartisan admiration over decades of public service under six presidents. Two exchanges have critics crowing about smoking guns, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. In February 2020, immunologist Christian Anderson wrote to Fauci, pointing to unusual features of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, suggesting lab manipulation. Critics call this proof that Fauci willfully ignored evidence of a lab leak. But several weeks later, Anderson wrote again to say his team concluded that the virus is not a laboratory construct. Critics also pounced on an exchange in which Fauci dismissed the value of the general public wearing masks. But as he has explained, that was before scientists realized the virus easily spreads indoors in aerosolized droplets from asymptomatic people. Like other conservatives, I've found Fauci to be slippery, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. But these emails contain no smoking gun evidence of wrongdoing. By demonizing Fauci, Trump supporters are trying to rewrite or distort the history of the pandemic, said Matt Visor and Yashim Abdulab in the Washington Post. Their story is that it was not Trump's downplaying of COVID as a little flu and his incompetent response that led to nearly 600,000 American deaths. Instead, it was a conspiracy involving China, Fauci, and the media to create and release a virus that ruined Trump's reelection. That's nuts. But these are the same people now insisting that the January 6th insurrection was nothing more than a peaceful protest by patriots. And to read a few of the shorter notes, starting with, though the number of miles American drove during the pandemic in 2020 fell 13%, traffic-related deaths rose 7% to an estimated 38,680. Federal officials blamed the increase on drivers speeding on less congested road or driving while impaired by drugs or alcohol. Donald Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, repeatedly pushed the Justice Department to investigate unfounded claims of fraud in the 2020 presidential election. In late December and early January, Meadows sent Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen five emails asking for investigations into numerous conspiracy theories, including that people in Italy used military technology and satellites to tamper with U.S. voting machines. A single wildfire in California's Sequoia National Park last year destroyed at least a tenth of the world's mature giant sequoias, some of which were more than 2,000 years old and 250 feet tall. I cannot overemphasize how mind-blowing this is for all of us, said forestry management expert Christy Bingham, who estimates the loss at 7,500 to 10,000 trees. Since the first COVID-19 vaccine was given to a 90-year-old in Coventry, England on December 8, 2020, more than 1.7 billion doses have been administered around the globe. It's equivalent to putting a person on the moon, said Cody Meisner, an infectious disease specialist. And we'll finish with a rather clever quote from Isaac Singer, quoted in Goodreads.com, who says, "We must believe in free will. We have no choice." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.